Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. I think you're going to like this episode. This episode is actually on the four challenges, four pressures that affect the family and try to divide it up and segregate it. And we're going to look historically as well as some current trends and things like that that we need to fight against in order to build a legacy of abundance for our family. They're pressures that most all of us face, and yet there are pressures that we can overcome if we're careful. And so we're going to take a look at that. I think you'll like that. Before we do that, I want to direct your attention to the business portion of this podcast. First of all, I want you to visit the website, take a look at the updates that we have there. One of the things you'll notice is that I have a members page now. And what I'm trying to do with the members page is I'm trying to offer a lot of value to those who are members. And so I've got a couple of downloads on there now, one of a debt snowball, where you can enter your debts and find out how quickly to pay those debts off by doing the debt snowball. There's a way to do that. And then also I have on there a grow chart that I've been using to grow my vegetables that shows different ways of planting and how far apart and when to plant and things like that. It's a chart I've developed that I use, and I think you'll find that helpful as well. Those are available to members. So if you're not a member and you haven't signed up yet to become a member of the Legacy Podcast and the community there, I encourage you to do that so you can take part in that. Now, as this community grows and as the resources become more and more available, then I will be requiring more for our membership to that site. But for now, it's all free to you, so check it out. Take advantage of that. Also, you want to connect with us on Facebook. And then also you can give us feedback. You can give us feedback in three different ways. You can give us feedback on each podcast on the website where there is a place for comments. You can enter comments there. You have to do that if you're a member. And you can make comments, give suggestions, say what you like, what you didn't like, that kind of thing. You can also give feedback on iTunes. I'd encourage you, if you're downloading this through iTunes, to give feedback through that. And then thirdly, you can give me feedback directly if you email me at feedback@thelegacypodcast.net. Again, that's feedback@thelegacypodcast.net. And I would encourage you to do that so that I can find out what you all are enjoying, what you're liking, what you're benefiting from, what things you'd like to see in the future episodes. That would be of great help for me as well as for the rest of the audience. So I appreciate that. That just about takes care of all of the business. So let's go ahead and get into the content of today's episode. So there are several, I could go on with the whole list of different pressures that are affecting the family in a negative way and trying to segregate and destroy the family and divide it all up. But I've narrowed it down to four that I want to look at today. And the first one is this: the Industrial Revolution and the workplace. By what I mean by that is we're going to take a look at historically how the Industrial Revolution has worked to diminish the role of the family, how it's worked to diminish the role of the family, how it's worked to prevent the family from coming together and has divided it up. And, you know, the Industrial Revolution had some good things about it. Of course, it increased our standard of living to some extent. It increased production. But I wonder at what cost. I think the Industrial Revolution began the progress towards a divided family and a divided land. And so we're going to look at that. Now, prior to the Industrial Revolution, most economies were at the local level. And most people were tradesmen, craftsmen, farmers. They owned their own business, and they did business locally. They did business with people within their own community, people within their own towns, and within their own villages. So people worked from home or close to home, and so they were able to work together. They had an effect on one another with their work, and they took pride in their work, and they were to develop their craft. Most of them were small business operators. Maybe they were blacksmiths, or they were farmers, or they're silversmiths, or some kind of craft that they were able to develop, and they had more freedom because of this. They had freedom to work their own schedule, work their own hours. Many of them worked out of their own back shop or right next to that. Sometimes they would travel into town so they could be nearby, but most of them were able to be at least within a horse's ride, a short day's walk or something like that. Not even a short day's walk. I mean, just to, you know, walk around the block if they lived in town, that kind of thing. So they were really close to their work, which also enabled them to be close to their family and didn't have to be away that much. It also gave them more freedom to develop their craft. This allowed them to be experts in their craft and to develop a skill that they could then pass on from one generation to the next, which enabled families to have family businesses and to maintain those businesses from one generation to the next. And so you would have families that actually had names like Miller. And of course, those families were Millers. And you had others who were, related to their occupation, their name developed out of that. And then, you know, they could train their own children in those skills. They could pass on those skills from one generation to the next. And they would be able to apprentice them in that, which allowed them a great amount of time with their children and developing them into a trade and into a craft that they could use. Now, after the Industrial Revolution came on full force, many of the breadwinners, particularly the fathers in this case, had to spend long hours away from home. Dads were gone. Sometimes even mothers were gone for, you know, the vast majority of the day. This created a deficit in leadership in the home, which they then were able to transfer that to so-called professionals who made up that deficit outside the home. Many of these people were, you know, paid professional teachers. Up until this time, as we'll see in a little bit, most schooling was done on a local level, or at least a lot of it was actually done even in their own homes, and fathers would instruct their children. Sometimes they would, you know, pay for somebody at the local level to school, but it was a very localized activity. But after the Industrial Revolution, this became much more regionalized, and there was a lot more commute to work. There was a lot more involvement outside of the home as this grew. And then work, of course, did not directly impact the family. And so there was an emotional and a mental and a financial separation from the father's work and his place in the home. And before this, of course, they were one and the same. The family and the business were the same. It was a family business. They worked out of the home. They cooperated together. Many of them worked, you know, the father, son, mom, they all worked together in the business. But then after the Industrial Revolution, the father would go away and the family wouldn't have much to do with his business. And so it was kind of a compartmentalized life. So if you can imagine this, if someone went to an industrial plant and produced something through the industrial process, many a times they were involved in a very tedious or monotonous type task that they couldn't really connect with at home. Their family couldn't connect with. It was something that they couldn't train their children in. It was something that they couldn't develop a craft in. It was just a product that they were, even just a small segment of that product that they were involved in. And of course, this had ramifications on the family that was devastating. And then it was less self-sufficiency as a result of this, because the father was going away from the home so often to go into town to work or into the cities to work. He became more and more dependent upon his employer and less dependent upon himself and upon his family, upon his community. And as a result of that, many of the loyalties switched from the community and the family to the business and the company that employed them. Less time on work on the homestead was also a result. In other words, no longer was he around enough to build a homestead that could then be passed on and the qualities of that homestead be developed. But instead, he was going and working for a corporation so that the corporation or the business could be built up. And this, of course, changed the way in which the family was able to operate as well. And then, of course, there was migration from the towns into the cities and from the villages and from the rural areas into the towns. And so this also was a change in the way in which families developed. Before, of course, they were mostly rural and small towns, and so they were able to have a close-knit community and a family that was very close. But as the Industrial Revolution began to pick up steam and the migration happened, this began to change a different course. And then also the careers of these fathers that would go away from their homes became more and more specialized rather than life-based generalists. the integration that was there on the farm, or the integration that was there in the blacksmith shop, or the integration that was there at the furrier shop, or whatever it might be, that they were no longer there. They went off into the city or into the town to work, and so their life was no longer integrated, but rather compartmentalized, which, of course, caused a lack of unity in the home as well. And so what should we do? Knowing that this is the trend, and now, of course, what do we see in our culture today? We see mom going one way, dad going the other way to work, and, you know, the kids going off to school. We see this departmentalized life. We see that there's very little cohesiveness to the family unit. We see that the father is more committed to his corporation and working his way up the corporate ladder than he is to his family. And we see that the corporations care very little about the family, and it's mess now because of this industrial revolution. So what is our solution? What should we do as families that want to build a legacy that will last for generations? Well, one thing we need to do is that we need to start a family business. Because I believe that a family business is at the very heart of being able to maintain family unity. It's going back to the days where the family worked together on the farm, or they worked together in the print shop, or they worked together in the silversmith shop, or, you know, whatever trade they had, whatever occupation they had as a family, they worked together in that. And there's a great unity, a cooperation that comes together when there's a whole family working together towards one thing. Now, the great thing about today is that there are all kinds of businesses that can be started online. There's all kinds of activities that can be done as a family with very little cost, and they can be developed. There's all kinds of books on that. And, of course, I've chosen several different businesses over my last 10 years to do, and right now I'm focusing on the farm to some extent. And that's a great business to start, but not everybody has the ability to be farmers anymore, and certainly land is cost prohibitive. But that doesn't mean that there's no business out there that a family can start. There's all kinds of businesses that you can start. And I'm going to put a link in there to some podcasts and some resources that are available through Vision Forum regarding that. And so start a family business. That's one way to overcome the influences of the Industrial Revolution in the workplace. But the second problem, or the second pressure, the second challenge that is facing families that has resulted in a segmented or fractured family is the implementation of age-segregated instruction in all areas of life. And so, first of all, this really occurred in the schools. Now, originally, there were very few schools. Most people schooled their children at home. They developed a way to educate their children while they worked at home and while they were training them in the various crafts and skills that they developed. But over time, this changed to where there were some who had village schools. And, you know, I think probably the most familiar for most of us to think about is the one-room schoolhouse that's pictured on Little House on the Prairie. And, you know, one teacher and all the kids in the class, from the youngest one who was just barely beginning to read all the way up to the older boys who, you know, were always in the back messing around, that kind of thing. And, you know, they were able to get a basic education from that model. Most American schools were ungraded until the influence of a German-influenced Quincy Grammar School of Boston in 1848. In fact, I remember my grandmother taught in a one-room schoolhouse, and she was born in 1902. So, you know, the idea of this one-room schoolhouse, this ungraded educational model, was, you know, prevalent for the vast majority of the United States' existence, from the colony period all the way up until, you know, the early parts of the 20th century, that was true. So she was teaching, you know, 1917, 1920, 22, somewhere around in there, and she was teaching in a one-room schoolhouse. She was, I remember she was showing me actually some of the material that she used. She still had the books for a long time. I wished I would have kept them. But there was a history, math, and reading and literature is what she was responsible for. So basically the reading, writing, arithmetic that we consider as fundamental in grammar school. And so the early educational model was a non-segregated and ungraded type model. And even before that, and even in conjunction with that, there were many who homeschooled and you know, they read to their kids and taught them, you know, basic arithmetic and things like that at home. Most parents, if they did not teach their children themselves, were intimately involved in the education of their students because it was all at a local level. And you know, there was a small class, small schools, and that kind of thing. Now, this influence of age segregation after the Quincy Grammar School came about, and even up until like the 1940s is really when it began to be big in the schools. It also had its influence in the churches as well. And I'm going to use some of the notes that I took from a seminar that I took with Greg Harris when he was doing the Noble Institute seminars about 10, 15 years ago. And I'll put a link in the notes to that institute if it's still in existence. But he has in that an outline of some of the ways in which the influence of segregated schools got involved with the church and has caused problems since then. So the noble beginnings of Robert Raikes is where it starts. And he was in Gloucester, England in 1780, and he saw that many of the poor miners' children were not being educated at all to read and to write. And so what he decided is, as a means of outreach and education to them, he was going to take Sundays and he was going to teach them some reading. And so that's how it began, under noble ambitions to teach the children of these immigrants in the community who were in mining. Now, by 1790, 10 years later, the Sunday school became a fishing net for evangelical outreach. In other words, what happened is they thought, well, you know, this, we not only need to teach them reading, but we can also use this while they're reading the Gospels and reading the Bible. We can use it as a way to reach out to those immigrant children who are lost and bring the gospel to them. And so, you know, the idea there was that, you know, it was based on, you know, some right ambitions of being able to, you know, reach a generation of children that were unchurched. But the problem was, is that because the focus was not on the family and not on the parents, but rather upon these children, that the pattern, the slope that they were on was a slippery slope, and the pattern was towards segregation and not towards integration. And so what do we find by the 1870s? And even up into the present, the influence of the professional education class, the professional teacher, so to speak, began to influence the Sunday schools. And they said, well, this, you know, this is a great way for education to take place on Sundays as well. And you know, this model of age segregation began to make its way into the school systems. And so, you know, if you look at a Sunday school class, or you look into a church and you look at the Sunday school class, the whole concept of, you know, individual classes all scattered throughout the church, that wasn't modeled after the Bible by any means. That was modeled after the segregated schools model in the public arena. And so we had this professionals push for Sunday school and youth groups as an alternative family. The idea is that, you know, this is where they could go to get what the family is not doing. And so it was a way for them to provide additional help to families. But by 1940 to 1970, the fishing net became a safety net. Bible teaching was offered for children of unsaved and passive parents. And so children would be dropped off at the school so that they could learn about the Bible and learn about God. And it allowed the parents to not take on the responsibility that was given to them. It allowed them to be passive parents. It allowed them to send their children for instruction elsewhere rather than to instruct them themselves in Christian things. Now, it's one thing to say that we are equipped as parents to teach math and to teach science and to teach literature and English and things like that, the traditional academic subjects. And, you know, then it's another thing to say that we are equipped to teach Bible and morals and religion to our children. And yet they weren't even doing that. Of course, I would agree that it's our responsibility as parents to teach all those subjects to our children. But certainly, at the very least, we as parents need to be teaching our children the scriptures and truths of the Bible. And so this fishing net became a safety net. And then we had the increase of bus ministries. that created an entirely alternative church experience. You know, I remember one of the churches that I pastored in Kentucky. When I pastored it, it was on great decline since its heyday in the 70s. And in the 70s, it had almost 20 buses that were going out into the city area, picking up unchurched and unreached children and bringing them into the churches. And they had this huge organization of Sunday school and youth group and children's ministry and vacation Bible schools and all these different kinds of experiences for these young people. And I look back on it, and of course, you know, the members of the church there looked at that as the heyday. They wanted to go back to that. And I looked at it and I say, well, what was the fruit of that? When I was the pastor there, none of the people were there that were bused. They all had left the church. There were none who had continued to stay in the church and remain faithful and raise up their children and disciple them. No, it was just a temporary experience designed to provide fun and activity for young people. And as a result of that, the faith was not passed from one generation to the next. And so that's a perfect example of this fishing net becoming a safety net. And then from 1970s to the present, this safety net became a hammock. Youth ministries created an entire alternative church experience. Many Christian parents now assume that their children are getting all of the Bible that they need and all the ministry that they need through all these various activities in church, Sunday schools and youth groups. And, you know, you talk to a parent today and they'll say, well, you know, I'm doing everything I can to get my children raised up in the faith. I mean, I take them to youth group and they go to youth camp and they go to all the youth activities and they go to Sunday school class and children's ministry, youth ministry, all these kinds of things. And we look back on it and we say, well, yeah, but what are you doing in the home to educate these children? Nothing. They're all relying upon some external experts to teach them what God has ordained us to do with our children. And so the safety net had become a hammock. Parents are now resting in the idea that everything is going to be okay because my kid goes to youth group. And I would challenge, if you are one of those parents who's listening to this right now, I would challenge you with the idea that you're actually doing more harm by doing that than if you were to take him out of the youth group and sit him down at home on Wednesday nights or whenever youth group is and read with him from the Bible and talk about it together as a family. That's going to do far more good than sending him to a Bible study with a bunch of people their own age group. And so let's look at what the church is like today. Today's churches offer something for everyone, but nothing for everyone. In other words, you can go to a church today. Let's suppose you go to ABC Church or First ABC Church in such and such a town. And, you know, it's supposed to be a great church, lots of activities for everybody. And so you go to that church and the dad arrives there with all the kids. He's excited about taking his family to the church. And he gets there and there's greeters there. And the greeter looks at the family and says, oh, great, I see that you've got a toddler here and you've got a youth girl and you've got a boy here who's in children's ministry. Fantastic. Well, what we need to do is I'll escort you to where they need to go. And so the father and the mother follow this lady to the wherever they need to go. And first place they do is they go to the nursery and drop the toddler off in the nursery. And they say, oh, we got great nursery workers here. They'll make sure your children are safe and take care of. He'll have a great time here in the nursery. We've got all kinds of toys to play with and Bible stimulating toys and all this kind of thing. And then they say, well, next we'll drop off Junior here at the children's ministry Sunday school class. And so they go around the corner and they go to the children's ministry Sunday school hour. And the parent is, you know, a little bit reluctant to send the kids in there. But the kid sees all the excitement going on in there. And he says, well, this won't be so bad. And so the person escorting them tells them that, you know, the child will just stay there during the whole time. He's got Sunday school class, and after Sunday school, they've got youth worship and children's worship. And so they got a special guy coming in to do some special music, and they're going to have a real fun time, great excitement. And then they go on to the youth building, and in the youth building, of course, they've got their own worship team and their worship service and youth stimulated activities, and they've got all kinds of ping pong tables around there and for all kinds of youth activities. And then the escorter then takes the mom and says, we've got a young women's class for you. You can go into that, and it's just right for you. Mister, you can go over here to the young men's class, and you'll be able to meet other men just like you're going through the same challenge. You'll be able to go to Sunday school with that. Now, at least the mom and dad get to come back together for worship service and are able to worship together as a mom and dad. Of course, their kids aren't with them in a church like that, but that is standard procedure for most churches today. In fact, it would be difficult for you, if you are a family of five, as this family is, to go to a typical church in a suburban area and all sit together for the entire time. It would be almost impossible. You'd be asked to be going to lots of different other activities. And so we look at the church today and we ask ourselves, is the church benefiting the family? I mean, they've got all these activities for the family, right? Well, they don't really have any activities for the family. They've got activities for individuals in the family, but nothing for the family themselves. And so what should our solution be with regards to the implementation of age segregation instructions in all areas of life? Well, we need to refuse to segregate the family. We need to make the church cater to the whole family, or find a church that will. There are a few churches. The National Center for Family Integrated Churches has a list of churches in the area that intentionally make it their goal to integrate the family together, not to segregate them out into all kinds of activities. And so we need to make it a goal of ours to integrate our families together in worship. And I'll talk a little bit further about what are the benefits of that is when you worship together. And I can't cover that in this episode, though. And then the second thing that we can do is homeschool. Now, earlier in an earlier podcast, you probably heard, if you didn't, go back, look it up, and you can just search for, under tags for homeschooling. It should be able to pop up. But I listed, why homeschooling is the best means for building a legacy. And I talked about, some of the arguments for homeschooling there. And so I'm not going to rehash those here. But certainly homeschooling is the best alternative that we have when it comes to building a legacy and integrating the family together. It is only in that kind of environment that a family can truly be together in all activities of education and instruction. And so the third pressure then that we find is what I like to call activity overload. And it's, it's related to some of the other ones, but it's also significant enough that I put it as a separate heading. Now, sadly, a recent study in Canada, now I'm sure that Canada is not much different than the United States. In fact, the United States may be even much worse in this account. But a survey of almost 11,000 Canadian families indicated that both high and low income families, so it didn't really matter whether you were, wealthy or whether you were poor, the same occurred. They spend less than half an hour each day together reading and playing with their children, even though they're reportedly said to have 5 hours of leisure time each day. In general, these parents said that their lives were too busied, too rushed. Now, we fight against this in our family, and I'm sure you probably fight against this in your family. It is a struggle that we face because there's so many activities that we can do for our kids and with our kids that it's hard for us to find the appropriate balance, and so we struggle with it. It's harder, the larger the family you have, the harder it is. Now, currently, right now, our youngest boy is playing t-ball in our county, and our third oldest boy is playing minors in our county league. Our second oldest son is playing soccer in a neighboring county. My oldest boy is trying to farm and play his guitar with some of the men for our fifth Sunday sing that's coming up. And this does not cover my work schedule or my wife's responsibilities, the schooling of our kids, the other responsibilities that they have and we have together, and trying to do the important things like family worship and time together and growing, in our relationship with each other and with the Lord. And so, we are in a constant battle, as you are as well, to find the appropriate balance of activities. We don't want to say no to all these activities for our kids because they can learn a lot and grow a lot through them. And yet we have to balance them so that we are not run ragged and so that we are not torn apart. We must be very intentional to keep the family together, or we will be fragmented to dust. Now, I know some families who have children in more than one activity at a time. I can't imagine how that would be possible to even manage that. And so what is the solution? Be intentional to limit segregating activities. You know, we, in our house, we're pretty much at max point here. And the idea that, you know, one of our kids would want to do two activities in any season, we just can't do that. That would be too fragmenting of the family. It's almost too much as it is now. Some of you are probably listening to this and you're saying to yourself, it already is too fragmenting. But that brings us to the second point, and that is be intentional to maintain family uniting activities. In other words, we can't let the segmenting, the ones that divide us as a family, usurp our time so that we cannot do those things that unite us together as a family. And so, you know, as a family, we have committed to family worship every day. Now, honestly, of course, we don't do that on Sunday because we worship together as a family in the Lord's house. But and usually we miss one or two other days during the week. But for the most part, 5 to 6 days a week, we are together as a family worshiping the Lord in the evenings and coming together for that. That allows us time to have unity together. And later podcast, I'll be talking about family worship and why to do that and what's involved in that. But for now, just let it be said that's a commitment that we have, and it allows us to be united together as a family. And then, of course, we have family worship or corporate worship on Sundays where we're together. And, you know, I have been intentional. The church in which I'm a pastor, it's a small little church, but, you know, when I first got there, some of them wanted me to start doing children's ministries and youth groups and all this kind of stuff. And I said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to worship together as a family. And, you know, the other families that we brought in have been of like mind. And so we've been able to prevent some of the dividing that takes place in the church and instead maintain uniting together in corporate worship. And then, of course, we work together as a family in our farming business as well. And some of my kids work with me in my other business. And so, you know, we have activities that we have intentionally been together working on that allows us to maintain unity. And then I would say that the third solution is to maintain the Sabbath, observe the Sabbath. You know, there is, I think it was last year, year before last, one of our boys made All-Stars in baseball, and All-Stars tournaments played on Sundays, and we told them we just won't do that. You've got to have some kind of boundary where you say enough is enough. And our boundary at that point was, we're not playing on Sundays. And so, you know, we didn't do that, and we maintained our standard there, which was a good thing. And so activity overload is another threat. The final threat I would like to comment on is what I've called technology threat. You know, everyone has their own electronic device these days. In fact, you know, I'm speaking right now on this podcast from my iPhone, which has, you know, a great deal of technological advancement in it. It is a great resource. I use it all the time throughout the day. And, you know, I wonder what I ever did without it. And so, you know, I'm not against technology, and there's a lot of value that can be found in technology. We use our computer, Mac computer all the time for research as well as for other activities. And so, you know, technology is not a problem. The problem comes is when technology begins to rule us and divide us as a family. You know, it's not unusual to find a family member listening to her iPod, her younger brother playing his DS or his PSP, mom on the computer, and dad watching TV, all segregated, all focused on their own little individual lives and not together as a family. Though they may even be in the same room doing all that, but they're not together as a family. But more normal is that they're not even in the same room. They're each in their own room, in their own individual world of games and electronics and technology. You know, technology can bring people together through Skype and through emails and Facebook and things like that, but it can also divide us apart. You know, in today's culture, it's not unreasonable for there to be TVs in every room of the house. And it's not unusual for, you know, Junior to be watching one program and Juniorette watch another program, Mom watching her program, Dad watching his program, and never are they together, even in the evenings when they could be together. And so, again, this is something that we have to fight against in our culture with technology so prevalent and so inexpensive and so accessible for us. And so what is our solution? Well, you know, I don't want to be Amish, and yet I think that their desire to be slow to implement technology certainly has a place. And we would be wise to be slower in our acceptance and use of technology. We must limit our electronic time. We have a rule in our house that, you know, electronics can only be used during certain parts of the day and for a limited time. And the rest of the time they have to do something else. And this is, you know, this is something is even this is a hard standard to hold to. And yet it's one that we need to hold to if we're going to maintain some kind of unity in our home. And then we have another standard in our home that might be helpful for you all. And that is that, you know, we intentionally built our house so that it's a very roomy house. And, you know, all of our main activities are in one room. It's one big room where we have the school room, we have the living room, we have the dining room, we have the kitchen, we have the computer. All of these things are all in one room so that usually, most of the time, everybody's together in one room. Now, the challenge with that is sometimes it can be really loud, and so it's hard to study and hard to learn in a situation like that. But at the same time, it also enables us to at least be together. We're not confined to our own individual lives and our own individual rooms. And so that's another thing, another suggestion you might be able to take and apply to your own situation. Well, hopefully that helps. You know, there's a great deal of pressure that is mounted for generations then that has, you know, split and divided the family. If we are going to leave a legacy, a family legacy, a legacy of abundance that will go for generation to generation, then we have to fight against this pressure. Evaluate the pressure that is in your family. They may be different than these. Most likely, you have the same pressures as I have here, and to a greater or lesser extent, you have them maybe, and you probably have some other ones that I haven't mentioned. And it'd be a good thing for you to sit down and to think about together as a family, what are the pressures on our family? What are those things that are dividing us? And then to look at ways of implementing procedures to limit those activities that divide, and then to begin activities that would unite together, such as a family worship and Sabbath and corporate worship and things like that, that would enable you to be together. So anyway, hope that helps to think about some of the ways that pressure our families to divide up and then to come together again. I'm going to include in the resources a list of a couple of resources that would be helpful to you. If you've not seen the movie Divided, I really recommend that you watch the movie Divided. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. And then there will also be a link to the National Center for Family Integrated Churches, which has a great deal of resources in there. Both, well, the National Center for Family Integrated Churches is already on my links page, but I'll put a particular link in the show notes for that as well. Anyway, thanks for listening. That just about takes care of this episode. And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy? They'll see that I live only for the cause.